Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White. I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune, Pastor Aaron Maddox of Cormdale Church, and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're asking the question, who are the Nephilim? That is the question.
Aliens.
Who?
Aliens.
Hey, there's all kinds.
Alien astronauts.
Hey, don't go on the internet and type in Nephilim because you get all kinds of conspiracy theories, baby. This could be one of the most amazing conspiracy theory generators in the world. But hey, Genesis chapter 6, verse 1, when man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. Now, my friend Will Walker and I have some friendly banter back and forth, and the crew at Providence Church preached Genesis 1 through 11 a few years ago, and then Will started texting me about every couple months and just chiding me that we had never preached Genesis 1 through 11 at Cormdale.
Yeah.
And he's like, what, are you guys afraid of the first 11 chapters of the Bible? Like, how come you don't want people to know how all this began? He was just like,
no, we're just afraid of the first six.
Right. He was just taught me. He was just taught me for not preaching Genesis 1 through 11. So we kind of were having some fun with it over text. And so I pulled up the messages at Providence Church, and I realized when they got to Genesis 6, they just started in verse 5.
Oh, classic.
And so I started pushing back and saying, Walker, you literally preached Genesis 1 through 11 and just skipped the passage that's the most problematic and that raises the most questions. You can't do that.
I guarantee you, if you went on every church's website, Genesis 6 starts with Noah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. If you've ever heard of Noah, that's Genesis 6.
That's what it's about.
Yeah, I'm just saying, if you're going to preach the whole counsel of God, you got to do something with Genesis 6, 1 mm-hmm. through 4. So it's talking about the Nephilim being in the earth in those days. I don't know what that's mm-hmm. talking about, but here's what's interesting. Aaron and Chris are going to answer the question for us, but I just want to read, this also comes up in the book of Numbers in chapter 13. You're probably familiar with this story when Joshua sends the spies to go scout out the land, right? And you remember 10 of them come back and say, there's no way we can do this. You know, it's going to be hard. And then there's a couple of them that have faith and they say, the Lord's going to give this land to us. He promised that he would. But at the very end of Numbers 13, so they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them. So here's the next time in the Pentateuch that Nephilim come to the surface is at the moment of the conquest. And so I think we're supposed to see a connection, at least between these two passages. That Numbers 13 is a hyperlink back to Genesis 6, and we're supposed to think of when we hear of the Anakim and the sons of Anak, we should go, so they're connected to the Nephilim. So at least the interesting thing there is it's making a connection to before the flood. So, you know, this is Genesis 6 is the last account before Noah's flood. And then after the flood and after the conquest, we come to these people who are supposedly the descendants of the Nephilim or who come from the Nephilim. And so that's an interesting reference as well. So the question is, who are the sons of God? Who are the daughters of men? Who are the Nephilim? Are they giants? Are they aliens, Chris? So I think, Aaron, jump in here. I'm happy to survey sort of the possible views, but I'd love for you to just jump in at a textual level and just say, what do we need to do first of all, just to...
While you guys talk, I'm just going to say giants in the background the whole time.
Giants.
They might be giants.
We're going to get to that.
Well, if you have a footnote in your ESV, it just says, or giants.
Or giants.
There's no reason for that. That's going to be actually really important. I think the place to start, I think, is we need to ask the question, before we answer the question, who are the Nephilim? We need to ask the question, backing up to verse 2, who are the sons of God?
Okay, great.
So I think that we need to answer that question, then we can get to who are the Nephilim.
Yeah, because they did whatever they wanted there.
Exactly. It's kind of crazy, because it's the sons of God, they see... that the daughters of man were attractive. That's the Hebrew word for good. And then they take them as wives that they choose.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
see good take
shows
up here. So
this is the see good take. Same thing from Genesis 3. So how, you know, the fall narrative, as we classically understand it in Genesis 3, seems to be being replayed in Genesis 6 by the sons of God. Now, to the point of who are the sons of God, this phrase, Bnei Elohim, in the Hebrew Bible here, appears only 5 times in besides here in the rest of the Hebrew Bible. And one of the cases that Dr. Heiser makes and various other scholars have made is that when this phrase appeared, sons of Elohim or sons of God, when it appears in the rest of the Old Testament, it's always referring to spiritual beings that inhabit the presence of God. All right. So a few different examples.
Go.
Real quick. So Job 1:6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh.
Yeah, he's having a board meeting.
He's having a board meeting.
Getting the exactly. divine counsel in there.
And then later on in the book of Job, I won't go through all these, but Job 38 is one more. When this is the Lord speaking to Job, he says, the God does, where were you, Job, when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Seems like fairly clear references to some sort of spiritual beings.
Giants.
That are in the presence of God. There's various other Psalm 89, Psalm 82, Psalm 29, same kind of concept. So I tend to lean toward the idea that the sons of Elohim or the sons of God are spiritual beings, in contrast with two other very reputable and likely views. We can dive into those as well.
All right, so I'll summarize those real quick. I'm just looking at Michael Heiser's work in chapter 12 of his book. He sort of summarizes the possibilities here. The most classic view going all the way back to the time of Augustine is that these are Sethites. The sons of God refers to the line of Seth. The daughters of men refers to the line of Cain. And that what's the problem here, what's going on, is that the line of the godly seed was not supposed to intermarry with the daughters of Cain, and yet that's what happened here. And so that's been a position since about the 4th century, and that the problem here is that there's a forbidden intermarriage. You can think about all the connections of intermarriage throughout the rest of the Old Testament, Nehemiah and books like that, where, you know, the whole point is don't intermarry with pagans. We are the people of God, and we're to keep that, be faithful to him. The other possibility is that these are divinized human rulers. Think of it as like really powerful kings, really powerful earthly rulers who start to become arrogant in their pride. And so this is talking about human rulers that in some way are, I don't know what he means by divinized, Aaron, maybe you can fill that out a little bit.
It's the idea, so think maybe to step out of the ancient Israelite culture, but to one of Israel's neighbors, ancient Babylon. A lot of the kings in ancient Babylon saw themselves as essentially
sons
semi-divine.
Of the divine.
Yeah, sons of the divine, essentially. And so it's this not the ultimate God, capital G, but more than a mere human.
Gotcha. All right, so Chris, you're a convinced Sethite.
Well,
I'm
convinced, but I totally recognize one that because actually the position Aaron takes actually had a longer history than the Sethite view, because that's what common during the intertestament period,
right. the early
Christian fathers being very influenced by that. Long tradition there. And the intertextual connections, you know, strong case to be made there. I think the two things that have kind of landed me in the Sethite camp is one, and I know this is a little bit dangerous to do because I don't want to buck good biblical principles of going intertextual. But if you look just directly textual, if you kind of remove the references to, you know, Psalm and Job and just kind of go, hey, the context of what's going on in the first 6 chapters of Genesis leading to the Noah story, coming out of the genealogies in 4 and 5, all of that, that it just contextually, that this is grounded in kind of a human dynamic, I think, in kind of leading up into, you know, God's judgment of the world for human sin. I think it makes more sense contextually if you're looking at direct context. But the thing, and this is, I may actually be able to slide into your view, Aaron, if you can help me with this. This is the biggest part for me, is just the metaphysical argument of this.
What happens here?
Who are the Nephilim kind of coming out of, like, you know, for the Sethite view, that they're, you know, if you kind of read the text, it's not, you know, in the Hebrew, it's not necessarily directly saying, it's implied that the Nephilim are the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men, but it isn't directly stated there. They exist at the same time.
Sure.
But having said that, I'm totally down with giants, man. I am totally down with this idea that they're giants. I have no problem, even with in my view, that there were this, you know, giants, these, you know, mighty warriors, like where they came from. Good question. But I think that's the thing that I've wrestled with the most in that is I see the textual arguments. It makes a lot of sense textually. And okay, I can almost get there. But the metaphysical side, and then even, you know, how Jesus refers to, you know, in, you know, angelic beings, do they procreate? Where did this ability to procreate come from? Where Jesus seems to make a contrast between, you know, heavenly beings, you know, like the angels in heaven don't procreate, that kind of thing. And then maybe I just don't want to live in a world where fallen angels can reproduce with humans.
Yeah, that seems a little, yeah, crazy.
So, hang on. Some of those things are kind of my, that kind of metaphysical argument is in some ways probably the biggest hurdle for me.
All right, so let me take us back to the title of the podcast, the question Dusty started us with.
Who are the Nephilim?
Who are the Nephilim? Genesis 6:4 indicates or implies the Nephilim are the offspring of what happened when the sons of God took wives from the daughters of men. Mm-hmm. Okay. The two interesting things here that you just mentioned that I want to fill out a little bit for listeners. So you mentioned in the last podcast, Aaron, that text in Isaiah that just takes the word seraphim and just pulls it over. That's the same thing that's happening here. Nephilim is just a Hebrew word that's literally just being transliterated into English. Yep. And so the reason you don't know what it is because you're like, it's just a Hebrew word that got stuck in your English text.
And capitalized.
In the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, this is translated gigas, giants. That's why the ESV has that footnote, because in the Greek text, when the Greek translators were asking, how do we translate Nephilim into the Greek language, they used the Greek word for giants. It certainly seems from the narrative in Numbers 13, why are they scared? It's because when they went in the land, they saw the Nephilim and they were large. They appeared imposing. And so I think we're supposed to see there's a connection here to some Canaanite peoples who seem to be very large human beings. Think Andre the Giant. You know, think about the people you've seen, the movie characters that are just like, all right, this guy's huge, you know.
That's who it is.
Yeah.
It's Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
He's Nephilim.
I mean, he was the reason he had all those amazing roles in movies like The Princess Bride is just because he's a unique physical specimen. You know, it's just like there's not many people as big as that. So there's this connection to the idea of giants. Or the idea of large human, large mighty warriors, large human figures. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Goliath is connected. Okay,
we should talk about
Aaron's
that in a second.
Aaron's going to take us there. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you mentioned, Chris, that I want to point out is you mentioned some intertextual connections. And part of the reason that the Jewish, the Second Temple Jewish understanding was that these were some kind of divine beings is because of the books of Peter and Jude. Right. And so I want to read from 2 Peter and from Jude that seem to be referencing this event. So let me read from 2 Peter, chapter 2. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but held them captive in Tartarus with chains of darkness and handed them over to be kept for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a proclaimer of righteousness, and seven others when he brought a flood on the world of the ungodly. And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction, reducing them to ashes, having appointed them as an example for those who are going to be ungodly, and rescued righteous Lot, worn down by the way of life of lawless persons in licentiousness. Skipping to verse 9, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to reserve the righteous or the unrighteous to be punished at the day of judgment, and especially those who go after the flesh in defiling lust, and who despise authority. Likewise, Jude only has one chapter. So Jude verse 5. Now I want to remind you, although you know everything once and for all, that Jesus, having saved the people out of the land of Egypt, the second time destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels who did not keep to their own domain, but deserted their proper dwelling place, he has kept in eternal bonds under deep gloom for the judgment of the great day. So these two writers seem to be referencing back to something that involved angels intermixing with humans in ways that were defiled. And these are based on a Jewish text called First Enoch, or the Book of Enoch, which is an intertestamental apocryphal Jewish writing that obviously Peter and Jude are both familiar with, and that sort of perhaps has sort of built out some, I don't know, mythology around this. These Jewish texts are interesting, the ones that are not scriptural, because they seem to reference these accounts, but then there's also ways that they're sort of mythical in some of what they say. But it's clear that both Peter and Jude, as inspired authors of scripture, seem to believe there are angels who sinned.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. The language that Peter uses, for God did not spare angels when they sinned, 2 Peter 2 verse 4, and then Jude verse 6, and angels who did not keep their domain. When you go back to Genesis 6 in the Septuagint, so the Septuagint would be the Greek translation of the Old Testament, I don't know, 100 to 200 years before the time of Jesus. Genesis 6 verse 2 in the Septuagint says, the angels of God, having seen the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, took for themselves. So the Septuagint's using the same language as Peter and Jude. So I think that, just to kind of uphold your connection there, Peter and Jude, I think, are referring to Genesis 6.
Why does Chris not agree with you?
Well, I mean, to your point, we should talk about that metaphysical question.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's, help me with this, because I haven't read anything satisfactory. So
hang on, I'm trying to keep our listeners with us. Yeah, so when we talk about the metaphysical, we're talking about how does an angel have sex with a human being. Let's just state it like it is, right? We're talking about
I haven't done a ton of reading on this, but a couple things that popped to mind. First is, like, we should just acknowledge that this is a very strange story.
Yes.
Just to be okay with that and to not feel and I think we should have that sort of reaction. I think the biblical text is like this is not how it's supposed to be, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, like, to be a Christian, we do believe some very strange things.
Right? Like the resurrection.
Like the resurrection, the virgin birth. Like, there are a lot of doctrines that don't make sense to us logically. So there's that piece. There is an element some people do believe, and I'm not saying I agree to this, but as a potential option, the intermixing of angelic spiritual beings with these women. Some people think that this is actually more, not necessarily like sexual in nature, as much as it is like worship and divinization and handing oneself over to these spiritual beings as far as like their worship goes, so that their offspring are essentially practicing this, like, I don't know, demonic type of worship as their generations continue.
Almost like a demon possession.
Exactly. So that's one way to think about it. So that is an option. I don't know if I'm going to, put my cards in that camp. Just putting that out there. I mean, there is the other option, is kind of how the text seems to read, if we are to take these as spiritual beings, is that there's some just weird, messed up way that this is happening. And the biblical authors, as the story progresses, are going to say the offspring of these spiritual beings and human women are not to be dealt with. I mean, they are to be dealt with in the sense, like, we need to get rid of them because they're corrupting God's people. They're leading to idolatry. They're leading to all sorts of problems later on in the Old Testament. So I hear you there. Like, that is, it's messy.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think there's very grounded exegesis to make the case versus kind of the conspiratorial, like, versions Aliens. Of this. Yeah. 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 So, I can respect that exegesis. Like, there's a lot of argumentation to be made there. So would you see, cause I've also heard this as part of that viewpoint, that the flood was intended to wipe out the offspring of sons of God, daughters of men. That's part of behind the flood, is wiping out these giants.
Part of it. I think where I push back on that view is there's some that want to make the flood all about wiping out whatever these offspring are. And it minimizes, like, just regular human sin. Mm. And I want to kind of have my cake and eat it too. Like, it's a both and.
Yeah.
Like, human sin, like, humans are responsible for their sin. And there's some, I'm kind of take the position, there's like some spiritual evil happening here. And that's why this whole thing is a mess. And God's going to essentially hit reset on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring in a couple threads. One is, I just want to give a shout out to my friend Bethany Gilbert, that if there's any passage in the Bible that would lead me to talk about aliens, it's this one.
Yep.
Because
we see you.
Because if there are divine beings who are capable of interacting with humans in strange ways, it's just like, I could go down some pretty great conspiracy alien theories here, just at the level of the metaphysical, right? Yeah. Of just like, hey, if this is, if interaction between the divine and human is possible, and if there are dark divine beings who want to in various ways interact with humans, that opens up a ton of possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The second, that's just an aside, because Bethany has wanted us to talk about aliens for like three years. So here we go. This is
that's as strange as Bob gets right there.
That's as strange as I get. But the other thing is, I want us to remember that, you know, the Pentateuch is written, at least in its substantial authorship, by Moses and on the plains of Moab as the people are getting ready to enter the promised land. So Numbers 13 and Genesis 6 are written at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. They're talking about different periods. But I think if we're taking an author's perspective, mm-hmm. right, if we're original author, what is he concerned with? I think primarily what he's concerned with is the people are about to go into the land. And if he knows there are these people, these descendants in the land, the sons of Anak, he knows they're going to encounter these people and they're going to be intimidated by them. And so part of what's happening here, at least, is he's trying to tell the backstory of where did these people come from and what is God's view of them?
Yes.
How ought we to understand God's judgment of these giants or these sons of Anak? And so at some sense, regardless of how we sort out who the sons of God are and who the daughters of men are, part of what we're supposed to see here is the Nephilim should not scare you, Israel. You should go in there and understand they've already been judged by God back in Genesis 6. Yep. And if the flood was intended to be part of God's judgment on them, you're to carry that forward as you enter the land.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I think to your point, Genesis 6, verse 4, there's that line, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward. What's the afterward? It's got to be Numbers 13. It's the only other time the word appears.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's clearly as Moses is collecting and writing Genesis 6, what we call Genesis 6, he has an eye toward Numbers 13 and getting God's people to enter into the promised land.
Right.
Which is why you would say the flood didn't wipe them out.
To go back to a previous podcast.
Yeah.
Maybe the flood was regional. I don't know.
So how do you get to Goliath? What's your just for fun?
Yeah.
Talk to us.
So we got do a little bit of a journey of like Numbers 13 and trace a few passages here. So to what we were saying a moment ago, the footnote in your ESV has the footnote to giants.
Giants.
Which gets us which is coming from the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Bible. So a couple things here. The word Nephilim potentially comes from a Hebrew verb to fall. So this might be speaking of these spiritual beings that have fallen, in a sense. So back to a previous podcast of like God's divine counsel, these spiritual beings could be these fallen angels, we might say. Heiser thinks it might be that, but he more so thinks this word Nephilim comes from an Aramaic word. So this would have been kind of one of the primary languages towards the end of the Old Testament period for the God's people. A Hebrew word that actually means giant. So there's some intertextual connections there. Now, that kind of in the background, whatever these beings are, it seems to be like giant is there. Now, when you get into Numbers 13 and into the rest of like the conquest, I think, which we would just go back to this Numbers 13 passage. Numbers 13, 28 says, "Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev. The Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country. And the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." Notice in verse 28 of Numbers 13, their cities are fortified and very large. And again, they saw the descendants of Anak there. And then it goes into verse 29. All these people groups, the Amalekites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, you could potentially read all those people groups as being part of the descendants of Anak. Okay? So that's the first connection. The people groups in the promised land potentially could be connected to the descendants of Anak, which are connected to the Nephilim. Okay, so that's
and sidebar, it seems like frequently in the Old Testament when it talks about entering the land of Canaan, it names all those people.
Yes.
You're entering into the hand of the land of the Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites.
Exactly.
Right? It names all those people.
And as a good Bible reader, we're to kind of just keep these pieces together, these connections, that Moses Genesis 6 is the start of it. The Nephilim and all these people groups, the descendants of Anak, the Hittites, all these ites that we sometimes say, they're all part of this mysterious giants kind of people group. Now, in verse 33, verse 32, the land through which we have gone, these are the spies, and spying out the land, is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw are men of great size. Okay. So there's that. We've kind of talked about that. Those, that's the giant sort of language there.
There they are.
There they are. There's giants in the land. When you get to the book of Deuteronomy, as they're, again, still prior to actually entering into the promised land, it says in Deuteronomy 2, verse, let's call it 10 through 11.
Just call it that. Yeah, let's just
about there.
Trying to figure out like where I should start here. So starting in verse 10, the Amim formerly lived there, a people great and mighty and tall as the Anakim. So speaking of a particular people group, saying that these people are just as tall as the Anakim, these giants. Like the Anakim, they also counted as the Rephaim, which is just another parallel word, but the Moabites call them the Amin. Okay, so all I'm trying to do there is
you got to translate some of that for me.
All I'm trying to point out is that this is just another data point in the Pentateuch of these Anakim being referenced as very tall
giants.
That's all I'm trying to point right now. When you go into the actual conquest narrative, the book of Joshua, Joshua 11, starting verse 21. And Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim. So by this point, if you're reading through the Bible, you know who the Anakim are. They're the descendants of Anak. They're connected to the Nephilim. They're these giants. Joshua came at that time, cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua devoted them to destruction with their cities. There was none of the Anakim left in the land of the people of Israel. This is important. Only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod did some remain.
Guess who came from there, Dusty?
Guess who came from one of those three places? Okay. So maybe see where this is going. Just one more fun data point. Caleb, when he's like, give me some more. I got more energy
I'm
left.
80, but I'll go kick some butt.
I'm going to keep going. Joshua 14, verse 12, he says, so now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. So Caleb wants to go drive out some Anakim. He wants to go take out some giants. So back to that line though, in the book of Joshua in chapter 11, verse 22, there's some Anakim that are left over in Gaza, in Gath, in Ashdod. When you get down to the fairly famous David and Goliath story, we're told that Goliath, and we all know the children's story, he's a giant.
Yeah, right? He's definitely a giant. That's what they told me.
That's what they told you in Sunday school. And you get that detail in the book of 1 Samuel 17 that he's from Gath.
Boom.
So you put some of the data pieces together. It's very much textually possible that Goliath himself, he's a giant, he's from Gath, he's checking all the boxes. He is somewhat of a descendant from the Anakim, Nephilim, giants. And part of what David is supposed to do, when you go to, I think it's 1 Samuel 21, there's a whole section there where David is essentially wiping out all these Philistine giants. And what David is doing, he's continuing the conquest, the book of Joshua.
Yeah.
Did you mean 1 Samuel?
1 Samuel. Did I say 1 Samuel?
Yeah, you sure did.
I'm proud of you. Good job. Way to be an American. Way to be an American.
That's an amazing flowchart. I mean, that's really good textual work, but it's also worshipful to just trace it that far into the text.
Yeah.
I am actually just seeing for the first time the connection you made in Numbers 13, Aaron, when it talks about we saw the descendants of Anak there, and then it names the Amalekites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites. Yep. And I'm making the connection to Deuteronomy chapter 7,
yep,
when the Lord your God brings you into the land that you're entering and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you.
Mm-hmm.
When the Lord God gives them over to you, you defeat them. You must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons.
Sounds like Genesis 6.
Yep.
Sounds like humans.
Yep.
No.
So it does sound like there's a consistent connection here in the conquest.
Yeah. And what you did, I mean, that's to kind of just add what you've already been saying, that whole judgment piece that David continues and completes, where's the justification for that all the way back in Genesis 6, God's judgment on the Nephilim.
Yeah.
And so tracing that out of the existence of these guys, but then also God's treatment, which gives further moral justification or kind of explanation of conquest.
Yes. And I think there's, I think more work to be done, at least from my perspective of some like Old Testament studies on, you know, these apologetic questions on the conquest. Mm-hmm. I think what Heiser is kind of teeing up, he doesn't explicitly go here. I think there's some good potential work to be done of talking about if these Nephilim are descendants of intermarrying of spiritual beings and these humans, and that they're like these kind of corrupt spiritual beings, these giant mystical figures. All these conquest commands, like in Deuteronomy 7, for example, and other places, we're
just kill them.
Just kill. It's killing them. It's targeting these spiritual beings that are corrupting God's people. And it's not how we might think of like genocide in our day. This is real spiritual warfare going on. And it's very much Paul's being consistent when he says we do not wrestle against flesh and blood.
Yeah.
Like Joshua's doing that. And I think there's very much good. I want to do more work here, but I think there's some potential to flesh that out.
Mm. Well, and that's the interesting thing to me about Heiser's view, going back to the metaphysics, is he's saying, hey, if there really are fallen beings, fallen heavenly beings, and if they really are seeking to corrupt humankind in whatever way Genesis 6 is talking about, and if there are therefore either demon-possessed or, you know, descendants of this sort of rebellious spiritual mm-hmm. beings, then of course we would see justification for why God would want to say, don't give these people any ground, don't intermarry with them. And in fact, don't let them live in your land. So it is interesting. There's something there that feels more just to me than just, hey, these are pagan, you know, they don't worship the same God as you. So, there is something
that's a little thicker there
in terms of what we're.
So do such beings still exist or did we get them all?
Well, whole rabbit hole that I'm sure we don't have time for, but guys like Heiser and there's others doing work here and that they're kind of basing it off of some of the intertestamental literature are going to say the question of like, where do demons come from? Where do these spiritual beings that don't have physical bodies come from in the Gospels? Taking some of the work here in the Old Testament, some intertextual or intertestamental work. Some people think, again, we can debate this and talk about it, that demons are the offspring or the spirits that remain from these giant figures being killed off in the Old Testament. And that there's a connection to the Rephaim. If we had more time to do some textual work on the Rephaim, the Rephaim in the Old Testament are connected to spirits of these deceased figures that have come before.
That's a whole other.
So we're not sure.
Okay.
That's him saying, I don't know, Chris.
That's an interesting way to say, I don't know.
Yeah. Possibilities.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Let me just.
I'm a little bit tongue in cheek here, but I'm also asking a little seriously too. Are there such beings that still exist in the sense of like, if I see a really tall guy walking down the street, am I like, hey, Nephilim? Like what's going on here? You know? Or is there, I guess maybe to ask the serious question is the existence. I mean, you know, Paul talks about we don't wrestle flesh and blood. It really is a spiritual battle. So is there a sense at the physical level, while the spiritual side of this battle continues, but at the physical level, these beings have died off, been killed off. And so now it has shifted to a spiritual type battle.
I think that's what Paul, when we're putting all the data pieces, if you will, together. That's exactly, I think, what Paul is saying at the end of the book of Ephesians.
Let me mention one more thing before we close this fascinating podcast on the Nephilim. And by the way, maybe all we've done is provoke more questions in listeners. And so you're welcome to send us an email and let us know if there's other aspects of this conversation you'd like to hear us talk about. But Michael Heiser points out that Genesis 6, 1 through 4 is a polemic, meaning it's a literary and theological effort to undermine the credibility of the Mesopotamian worldview. So keep in mind, Moses is writing into a context. These people are surrounded by ancient Near Eastern cultures that all have their own myths of where did the world come from and how did we get to where we are. And part of what Moses is doing in telling the story in Genesis is undercutting those myths. One of the interesting things that Heiser points out is that in Mesopotamian culture, there were the Apkallus, who are supposed to be these sort of like semi-divine figures that are like preserve wisdom from before the flood. We said in a couple podcasts ago, the story of a massive flood is the most well-attested story in every ancient Near Eastern culture. Every culture around Israel also shared the memory of some massive catastrophe that involved a flood. And so each of these cultures had these stories. And in Mesopotamian culture, the Apkallus were these semi-divine sages who had knowledge from before the flood. Sometimes they lived for thousands of years. They were sort of, these cultures understood these to be the figures that have wisdom. And so whereas you see in these cultures surrounding Israel, this sense that there's these semi-divine beings that if we could just get to them, they would teach us wisdom. You see Moses doing the opposite of like, anything semi-divine is not good. It's probably demonic. It's probably opposed to the one true God, and you should absolutely not seek wisdom there. You should actually seek wisdom in the Torah. So it's interesting also to remember, even as we explore like who are the Nephilim, to also remember that also this story is doing work apologetically for the Israelites to remind them, hey, don't believe the stories that are being told in the cultures around you. There's one God who's made the world, and there's one way he's made us to live. And so part of these warnings in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, part of this story is to remind them, don't be trying to have any communion with the divine outside of worship of Yahweh, because that usually doesn't go well.
Well, as we read the Bible, our imaginations are provoked, and there's a lot of mystery that we can't fully get our heads around. But one of the things we can do is take heart with Ephesians chapter 6. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand, to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thanks for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.